Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
My title is Are We There Yet? And of course the answer is no, we're not there yet, which is I didn't think anybody would believe that we were actually there. And what I wanted to convey was sort of this sense of impatience and urgency that I feel, at least. It's like, for heaven's sakes, why aren't we there yet? What is it that we need to do to really make this happen? I think from the standpoint of thermodynamics, we should be able to regenerate the heart. We should be able to do regenerative biology in lots of things, but it's been harder than we thought. So we'll talk about some of the impediments and maybe some paths forward. These are my disclosures. I am a serial entrepreneur, which is sort of a pathological condition. Nothing leaps out of the academic world into the healthcare sector without a process of commercialization. And so we keep trying. So I have some equity disclosures to bring up. So this is the basic scheme that we are working with. The heart is essentially the least regenerative organ in the human body. It will make neuroscientists cringe when I say that, but I got the podium. And there's not a stem cell population in the heart that begets new myocytes. And the cardiomyocytes are very tightly locked out of the cell cycle. Smart people like Sylvia Evans keep working on this. Go, Sylvia, figure this out. But it's tough. So essentially, after one has large-scale loss of cardiomyocytes, the body is not up to the job of replacing them. The heart heals by scar formation, and there's a substantial drop, basically stoichiometric with mass loss, in mechanical function of the organ. And you might imagine it would be like a square wave, and we're down a step, but we'll hang in there. But we don't. It becomes a progressive illness, and in that sense, I think the word degenerate, it's kind of like a degenerative illness, if you will. And we don't know why the heart runs down, but it does. It's like this downward spiral of decompensation, and eventually a patient gets to the point where their heart function is not sufficient to support the blood flow demands for the body, and we call this heart failure. This is quite deadly. You have on average 5 years to live once you're diagnosed with systolic heart failure. So it's worse than most forms of cancer. So our approach is simple to understand. It's a disease of cellular deficiency. We can now grow almost limitless amounts of cardiomyocytes in the laboratory. We should be able to remuscularize the heart. Other people are working with other approaches. I mentioned reactivation of the cell cycle, some really promising things happening there with hippo pathway signaling and other kinds of stuff. I'm rooting for all the folks there. People are trying to reprogram and transdifferentiate cells. That's also a very challenging but potentially promising area. My thought is that I don't know if this will be the best way, but probably the fastest way that we can get large amounts of new muscle into a human heart and see what that does is by cellular transplantation. So that is what we have focused on. The first thing is you've got to get the cells, and with apologies to the developmental biologists in the audience, we had to take these beautiful interacting loops of activation and inhibition circuitry that underlie development of the heart and turn it into a linearized manufacturing scheme. And so it turns out to be all about Wnt, stupid, and I'm the stupid one in this case because it took me 5 years to figure this out. We kept asking simple questions like, well, is Wnt pro or con for making cardiomyocytes? And this turns out to be the wrong question because the answer was yes. And that's because you have to first activate Wnt to make mesoderm, and then you have to repress the Wnt pathway to commit the cells to forming cardiomyocytes. And it was collaborations with Randy Moon going back to zebrafish embryos where we finally figured this out, where we had spatiotemporal control over the pathway using fish genetics. And once the embryo taught us the lesson, we were able to then systematize this. Other people in bioengineering, Sean Polachek, for example, figured out how to do this with small molecules, agonists and antagonists. So we had to get away from these awful protein reagents that would fail at least half the time while we sent the people's children to college. So it now works. We can teach undergraduates to do this in 2 weeks, though it took us 5 years to get this figured out. We have brought this into pharmaceutical grade manufacturing. These are people working in a clean room under good manufacturing practice conditions. We can do this at scale. We've gone from monolayer culture to three-dimensional stirred tank bioreactors where we grow spheroids of cardiomyocytes. And we can do this up to 3 liters. So you can see a paddle wheel that turns. We stop the paddle wheel, and it's kind of like a snow globe, and you can watch it start to settle. It's a very expensive snow globe. A 3-liter run costs about $80,000 just in reagents alone. So it gets expensive to do manufacturing science inside of an academic setting. But we can produce cardiomyocytes at large scale, 8 billion. A typical infarct that causes heart failure would cause a deficit of about 1 billion cells, just for reference. And then we get these little cardioballs or cardiac spheroids or organoids or whatever you want to call them. These are some that we pulled out when they're young. It's a little hard to see them contracting. But we, in the video advances, we put in a calcium indicator gene called GCAMP. And you can see them, each little spheroid of a couple thousand cells will flash in synchrony. But each little spheroid, kind of like a miniature heart, beats to its own drummer. When these cells come out, they all have pacemaking-type action potentials, by the way. The whole heart, all the myocytes in the heart start out life as pacemaker cells, and then pacemaking with maturation becomes restricted to specific foci like the sinoatrial atrioventricular nodes. And so our cells have pacemaking properties. This comes back to be important later. We took cells with these GCAMP transgenes, transplanted them into the hearts. Here we worked our way up the food chain from mice to, you're not supposed to say food chain anymore, but from mice to rats to guinea pigs. I thought we were going to die before this ever got to humans. The cause of death would be listed as incrementalism. So we made the leap to a non-human primate, and you're looking at the apex of a primate's heart here. These gray streaky things are a grayscale image of the GCAMP fluorescence. I'll turn the video on, and so you can focus at the brightest spot, which is right up here, and watch it flash, and then you start seeing sort of the whole apex is flashing. And what that says is, this is several months after transplantation, that the cells are alive, they're well, they're beating, they're in sync with one another. If we then correlate this with the electrocardiogram, here's 3 different regions of interest where we grab the fluorescence intensity. And you can see all these 3 different regions are all synced up one with another, and that's what your eyes told you as well. But what you can't see is the electrocardiogram of the heart, which says that the sinoatrial node is calling the pace here, and the cells are following like good soldiers. So this is years ago that we did this work, but this said, okay, it seems to be we're on the right track. This is what regeneration should look like. We then went on to do an efficacy study in non-human primates, where we infarcted the animals first, came back a couple of weeks later, and surgically delivered using a needle and syringe the human cardiomyocytes into the infarct region. And so just to what you're looking, this is a confocal micrograph at low magnification. You note the size scale at 5 millimeters in the lower right. Red is monkey myocardium. In blue, a little hard to see, is an image stain for collagen. So this is the scarred region. So you're looking at the interface between the ischemic and non-ischemic vascular beds. And in green is the human myocardium that we have transplanted into it. And you can see that while the architecture is not perfect, the mass is substantial, at least in this section that I've chosen. And you might imagine this would be able to induce a better squeeze to the chamber. And if we use magnetic resonance imaging to quantify that, using ejection fraction as our principal metric, and that, by the way, is just the amount of blood that's squeezed out of the left ventricular chamber with each beat, you can measure this. And so each line here is a single animal. At baseline, the non-human primates, like human primates, have ejection fractions of about 65% or so, with some variation. And we infarct these animals, and they lose about 25 points here at what we call baseline. In the natural history group, the control that received just a vehicle injection, there's no spontaneous improvement. That is the natural history of disease, no regeneration, no improvement in function. And in the animals in whom we placed the cardiomyocytes, we get 8 to 10 points back at a month, and at 3 months, we get about 20 points back. So we're back up to the normal range. Even though these data were done several years ago, it is still the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning and says, you know, if the human cells can do this in a monkey, they should be able to do this in a human. This has been the thing that has kept me up. which is that the human cells, I told you that they follow the sinoatrial node. What I didn't add was the word eventually. And when we put them in, there's this period of electrical chaos that ensues. And this is, we've come to call this engraftment arrhythmia. This is a rhythm strip from one of the first primates in which we discovered this. They were on telemetry, so we had 24/7 rhythm monitoring. You can see a nice steady cadence here. And all of a sudden, chaos ensues. And the cardiologists would call this a wide complex ventricular tachycardia. And it turns out that this is the cells taking over the pacemaking of the heart with a wild and fast rhythm, in this case of about 250 beats per minute. We tried very hard to make this not due to our cells. We hadn't seen this in mice, rats, or guinea pigs. Why should this happen? But it's cells. So the natural history of this complication goes like this. The animals are infarcted here where the dots start along. There's four different animals shown here. And then the vertical line is where we came in and gave the cells. And you can see very soon temporally. So there's good temporal association. These arrhythmias ensue. And in some of the animals, it's a lot. You know, a good fraction of the day is taken up by ventricular tachycardia. The monkey tolerates this pretty well. Their hearts are about the size of a plum. They're a large animal technically, but smallish large animal. And their heart rates are naturally about 120 beats a minute. We tried this in pigs, and the pigs were quite unwell. And some pigs reached euthanasia criteria from their hearts being so rapid that they couldn't properly fill empty, and they went into heart failure. We did a lot of physiology studies. I'll just summarize that here, that I was wrong again. I thought this would be a problem of conduction disorder where we got this rhythm called reentry. It's kind of like people doing the wave in a sports stadium where it self-stims going around and around. That is not the physiology. The physiology is like an ectopic pacemaker that's going ping, 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 ping as an impulse generator. So I was lamenting this at a meeting where I was talking with a colleague named Kathy High, somebody I admire greatly. She's a hematologist, was at Penn and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Kathy was the first person to get a gene therapy approved in the United States, an AAV gene therapy for retinal blindness. And I said, you know, I've got this electrical problem. I'm a pathologist, not an electrophysiologist. This is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And Kathy just looked at me and said, like, put your big boy pants on, Chuck. You know, do you want to make a therapy? If you want to make a therapy, you have to own every problem that comes your way. You can't say, I'm not an electrophysiologist. You have, you know, if deal with it. And so that was annoying. But you know how things sometimes are annoying because they're true? And you know, it stuck with me. And I was finally like, yeah, I got to learn this electrophysiology and figure out what to do about it, because it didn't seem like anyone else was rushing into it. So we spent, we were ready to go to the clinic. And this was like a proverbial fork in the road. Do we go to the clinic when I know that there is this arrhythmia problem? Or do we stop and figure it out? Oh, and by the way, science is competitive and multiple other groups are doing this. And wouldn't it be great to be first? I mean, I'll just, you know, I'm competitive, right? And other people I suspect are competitive. So we decided to push pause and sort this out. And other people went on into the clinic. We did something I would recommend no one do, which was a CRISPR screen in pigs. We couldn't model this disease in culture because we didn't know what was causing it. And small animals don't get it. So we began to gene edit the action potential and to try to discover which genes coded for the ion channels that carried the arrhythmogenic current. And typically what would happen is we would make an edit or a series of edits in a cell line. We'd grow up large amounts of cardiomyocytes. We'd transplant them into the pig. Does it get engraftment arrhythmia? Yep, it still does. And so we got to the point where, and this is all during the pandemic, and you know, it was crazy. And we begin to wonder whether, does DNA really go to RNA, go to protein? Like, are we missing something here? And it turned out it just was complicated, which is to say, it seems to have been caused by three excitatory channels that are present on the sarcolemma. That are part of the pacemaking circuitry, and the absence of an inhibitory or hyperpolarizing potassium channel that's not present in immature cells but is in adult. And so we deleted these three activating channels and overexpressed this inhibitory channel, and we converted the action potential waveform from something with a pacemaking potential to a more hyperpolarized one with stable resting membrane potential. And schematically, we turned engraftment arrhythmia back into sinus rhythm. And you can see this shown quantitatively here that the arrhythmia burden, while not quite perfect, it's a 95% reduction. And so that told me at least we identified what the targets were. Maybe these cells would be a therapeutic. Maybe that's not the way to go, but at least we felt like we've got a handle on this thing now. We know when you don't even understand what you're dealing with, it's just very uncomfortable, at least for me. In parallel with that, we started using pharmacological approaches to find an anti-arrhythmic drug or cocktail that would inhibit this. And we'd switched by this point from non-human primates, because there's essentially no throughput to a primate model, to they're wonderful for discovery. But so we'd switched to pigs, and we brought in pigs while they had engraftment arrhythmia, and did short-term infusions of various FDA-approved drugs, and then we did some things in combinations as well. Lots of things didn't work, but we found two FDA-approved compounds called amiodarone plus evabradine. Evabradine targets one of the channels called HCN4 that we had to edit in order to make the arrhythmia go away, so that's physiologically making sense to us. Amiodarone ostensibly is a potassium channel blocker, but it is a it's a poor molecular probe because it's very non-selective, binds to all kinds of things. As a drug, it's kind of useful for that reason, because it's like a tonic, in a way. So cardiologists and surgeons use this a lot. But what importantly, so this is the average heart rate in the pigs with engraftment arrhythmia, and we brought it down to essentially normal with the amiodarone evabradine cocktail. And it was really, we learned this. It isn't the fact that the heart was being paced from a funny location. It's how fast it was going. When a large heart is going that fast, it can't fill well, it can't empty well, and it can't perfuse itself. And so that's just what causes this downward spiral. And then if I show you the Kaplan-Meier survival curves, the effects of this drug treatment was very impressive, at least to us. What you can see, each one of these steps down is one of the pigs reaching euthanasia criteria predefined with our veterinary staff. And so you can see these pigs were quite unwell while they had this. And so we lost, over the course of this experiment with a large dose of cells, 2/3 of the animals. And we had, the pigs were well, they were happy, and we had 100% survival with this drug treatment. So we thought, okay, we've got two approaches now. We've got a pharmacological approach to deal with this, and we've got a gene editing approach. So problem solved, right? So I just showed you pacemaking channels were required for this. You can target them with gene editing or with drugs. I don't know how it is with you. When we were like throwing high fives and we solved it, we understand the mechanism, and you're happy for a little while, and then like, wait, there's these little anomalies that you all have heard of. Occam's razor. Everyone knows Occam's razor, but do you know about Occam's broom? That's the thing you use to sweep under the rug, the little things that don't quite fit. And so these little anomalies started to emerge. Like, for example, these cells have the same ion channel repertoire when they're in culture, but they go about 40 beats a minute. So why are they going 250 beats a minute in after transplantation? Because that's partly why I was very glib about this before. I didn't think this would happen. And I also oversimplified when I described the targets that we edited, because I said I got rid of all the stuff that was in the fetal, all the excitatory channels from the fetal heart. But we had to do one other channel or ion exchanger that is robustly expressed in the adult heart, and that's the sodium-calcium exchanger, which is an electrogenic. It lets in three sodiums for it uses the sodium gradient to extrude calcium and let sodium in. So it's a calcium. It responds to calcium overload intracellularly. So thinking about this, it was like, I don't think we found a key set of nodal points in this causal chain, But there had to be something upstream that was driving this. Where was the calcium driver coming from that was running through this sodium-calcium exchanger? And so the only thing I could think of was that we had to have a calcium leak somewhere. There had to be calcium getting into the cytoplasm, either from outside the cell or from inside the cell, that was the driver of this arrhythmia. So we went back to some RNA sequencing databases that we had. And today we do this with spatial transcriptomics, but back when we did this in the previous decade, we had done this with laser capture microdissection and zapped out graphs from of human myocardium in the rat heart, in the infarcted rat heart. And we'd done RNA sequencing libraries and informatically deconvolved the human and the rodent sequences and so forth. And we'd watched our cells over a time course and as they mature. And we had focused a lot on ion channel gene expression that was at the sarcolemma. That's how we prioritized our CRISPR editing list. What we hadn't thought as much about was another part of the cell that's very important, actually, in ion fluxes, and that is this intracellular membrane. The endoplasmic reticulum of the cardiomyocyte is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or the SR. And we had a bunch of genes that had interesting dynamics there that we hadn't paid enough attention to. I mean, from cells in culture to 1 week, there was marked upregulation of the ryanodine receptor and triadin, two important parts of this. Further on, by 1 month, calsequestrins, circa 2A, et cetera. So it wasn't just maturation at the plasma membrane, but intracellularly, there were these dynamics at the sarcoplasmic reticulum that we had basically just not paid attention to. And so this led to the hypothesis that what our problem, maybe the upstream cause, is an intracellular calcium leak coming out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the cytoplasm and then running through the sodium-calcium exchanger and contributing depolarizing current. So we went back and decided to tackle this. And fortunately, a postdoc named Andy Westcott joined my lab. And Andy had trained with John Lederer in Baltimore and was really well versed in the biophysics of calcium. And he'd worked in mitochondrial metabolism in cardiomyocytes. And so he was keen to take this on. And so to have somebody come in with really good microscopy, biophysical kinds of skills was super useful here. And so we made a cell line that would be useful for this, which we took a line from the Allen Institute that had red fluorescent protein targeted to plasma membrane, and then we popped the latest and greatest version of this calcium indicator protein, GCAMP, into the cells so that we now had cells that were double positive. And we popped this in at the Kleibel locus using the chicken beta actin promoter. And we transplanted these cells into the hearts, and then during the vulnerable period at 1 week and from 1 week to 4 week, we took the hearts out and enzymatically dispersed the hearts to recover the grafts. And this is harder than it might sound because these cells don't like this. But Andy eventually acquired a very nice data set where we could do living cell calcium dynamics to see if we could see evidence for this calcium leak. So what did we find? These cells are not happy during this vulnerable period. So the next several panels, I'll show you a cell that's spent its whole life in vitro, a cell that's been in the heart for a week during the vulnerable period, and then cell that's been in for 4 weeks when it's coming out of the woods. And these are the GCAMP fluorescent signals that you see. And again, the cells are being paced here at a half a hertz. And it's hard to see this quantitatively, but they have pretty respectable calcium transients with a rapid upstroke and a reasonably brisk decay beforehand. We transplant them, a slow upstroke, a blunted peak, and a really slow decay with a long tail. These, by the way, look like they're just thick lines, but they're actually really tiny standard errors, because there's a bazillion cells that were done in this. So they've actually, this is data we have quantitative confidence in. And then 4 weeks later, this is normalized again. So that made sense. Calcium handling was mongered up in these cells. We also looked at cell clusters because we weren't sure which would be the more informative single cell, because it's obviously multicellular tissue in vivo. So we looked at cells that came out in clusters too, and we did the quantitation. Calcium dynamics are a little more normal in the cluster than they are in single cells. But again, we saw the same kinds of differences. I'll show you quantitatively what this looks like. This is the amplitude of the transient. Pretty decent before we put them in, bad after they've been in for a week, and then a rebound. Same kinds of things with clusters. We didn't do them in vitro. If we look at the time to peak, if long time to peak is a slow transient upstroke, and you can see it's fast in vitro, it's slow after a week, and it comes back down. Same for clusters. And then we also looked at the ability of the cells to be externally paced by field stimulation. And the ability to capture the cells goes down quite a bit at 4 weeks, either in single cells or in clusters. So there's a lot of dysfunctional stuff. But here's the thing that surprised me. I thought we would see a maturation profile where the cells would be it could be maturation, but it's not just maturation because things get way worse before they get better, right? And I showed you gene expression shows maturation, but physiology shows pretty healthy, very unhealthy, healthy again. So there is a stress response that induces, there's something about the transplantation that we have done that causes cellular injury that's manifest as bad calcium dynamics. The next thing was that we wanted to look for this spontaneous leak of calcium that we hypothesized. And so there's this thing that they're called calcium sparks, where these calcium release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum are called the ryanodine receptors. And they often plaque up to form these cooperative multi-protein, I'm no expert in this, but like hundreds of these guys dock up in sort of intracellular rafts. And they fire cooperatively. And when one of those units fires, it releases a little spark of calcium so that you can see that as well as the calcium transient. So this is what an in vitro cell looks like. It's just for reference. Then we're not pacing. We're letting them go spontaneously. This is what they look like at 1 week, and this is what they look like at 4 weeks. And what you can see, if you just watch this middle guy, there's the big calcium transient there, and then there's all these little funky things that are going on in the cytoplasm. And if you look at this in a quantitative way, you draw a region of interest and you just monitor it. There are these. So this is a calcium transient, and these little unitary things are calcium sparks. And there's way more of them in the cell at 1 week, and then they're going, they're basically gone or they're markedly reduced by 4 weeks. And we've got this quantified here. And this, I think, these little unitary releases of calcium, I think, are the culprit, that this is dumping calcium from the intracellular store into the cytoplasm, and that goes through the sodium-calcium exchanger and triggers the action potential, and that triggers the arrhythmia. So I think I just told you this. So yes, there's immaturity, but it's not just immaturity. There is a lot of gene expression dynamics that encode transcripts for SR proteins, but there's also this fact that there's an iatrogenic element to this, in other words, a physician-induced element, basically, where we stress the cells out through this process of transplantation, and this completely alters their calcium dynamics and induces a calcium leak. And I think it's this calcium leak that we've induced that is triggering it. It takes a combination of immaturity plus stress to happen. And after a month, the maturation is up, stress is down, and that probably is what makes the engraftment arrhythmias go away. Some of what I've told you is inferential. It's not like we've got genetic evidence for all. I consider this evidence, not proof, but this is the way I'm currently putting it together. So I'm going to pivot with my remaining time and talk about what I consider to be the biggest scientific barrier to regeneration in many areas of stem cell-based medicine, which is the immune system. And I'll start with one book. We'll go from bookend to bookend. And so we're going to start with autologous cells. And remember back in, 2000, it's 20 years now since Yamanaka first discovered iPS cells. And remember, we all thought, well, this is the answer. We're going to take our own cells, we'll make stem cells out of them, and we'll put them back into us, and we'll get rid of rejection. So that was considered to be the answer, at least that's how I thought about it. And then scientists came along and started slaying beautiful hypotheses with data. And what happened was, mostly from mouse studies, people were transplanting into what should be syngeneic animals, and they were getting rejection. Not all the time, but sometimes. And this hypothesis came about called the neoantigen hypothesis, where there are new proteins that are present in these stem cell-derived parenchymal-type cells, and that is leading to immune rejection. And certainly, like for mitochondrially encoded proteins, people correlated mutations in the mitochondrial genome with altered peptide sequences for mitochondrial encoded respiratory proteins and so forth. And it seemed like, yeah, this new antigen thing is a thing. And so since we had this primate model, we wanted to see whether autologous cells would work in the heart. And so we collaborated with an intramural program set of scientists at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, Cindy Dunbar and Manfred Bohm, two really terrific scientists who had great groups. Their chief lieutenants were Sogan and Youngshin, and then from my group, it was Kenta and Lauren. This was another pandemic project that was crazy, where we're flying back and forth across the country and so forth. And the timeline went sort of like this. We made autologous, we started with these rhesus monkeys. We made iPS cells out of their CD34 blood-derived stem cell or progenitors from them. And then we gene edited them to put in a reporter gene for PET imaging. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. So quite a bit of work goes into each animal. And then once we had the line and the cardiomyocytes manufactured, we came in, we infarcted the animals with a balloon catheter. Then we waited a long time. We waited about 4 months to mimic what would happen in a patient with an autologous situation, because it would take at least 6 months to have something ready to treat a patient. And then we flew back across the country and surgically transplanted the cells into the heart. And then we waited and we longitudinally monitored the animals. And then we terminated the study at 8 to 14 months after that. And this is in the imaging, it just shows you what, I mean, imaging is awesome. And to follow, you learn things with longitudinal tracking that are so hard to see with cross-sectional data sets because of animal-to-animal variants. And so we did, the reporter gene was the sodium iodide symporter. And this is a gene that codes for a protein that sits in the plasma membrane and is involved in iodide transport, brings iodide into the cell using the sodium gradient. And this is the basis for doing like thyroid scans in clinical medicine. And so we used a clinically active PET probe called 18-fluorine tetrafluoroborate. And when you do this in a healthy animal prior to infarction, or excuse me, prior to cell injection, what you see is this. This is a total body PET CT image. And you can see the butterfly-shaped thyroid gland. You see the distal stomach proximal duodenum, and then passive collection in the urinary system. But in the thorax, which is zoomed in here, there's basically just background. And here is looking 10 days afterwards, and this is the PET image, and then it's superimposed on a CT cross-section here. You can see the anterior wall where we transplanted the cells were present at 10 days, present at 1 month, present at 2 months, present at 12 months. And if we quantify it, you can see that this is a single animal. But we see a graph that goes up, plateaus between 2 and 4 months, and then holds steady. Doesn't look like neoantigen-driven rejection. It looked like a graph that expanded either through proliferation or hypertrophy, and then plateaus. At the study terminus, we took the hearts out and we looked for them for a couple of different things. So first, just to orient with the histology. The first question is, well, if they're autologous, how do you find them? And we used in situ hybridization for the sodium iodide symporter gene, because that's the transgene that we'd popped in as a reporter. So this is the infarct region along here in this heart, and the troponin just identifying it. And then this is the graft region with the sodium iodide symporter shown in red. And you can see also histologically, they integrate well, but they are not quite like the adult myocardium either. And this was a graft that was 14 months post-delivery. And one of the questions we had was, will these grafts fully mature? So what I'm going to show you is an 8-month animal, the heart from an 8-month animal, and a 14-month animal. And we're going to be looking at the graft-host interface. Again, the sodium iodide symporter is the key for identifying that. And then we wanted to, you know, what's going to be the index of maturation that we'll use? We'll use this troponin switch that happens. It's one of the late events. And so this, from the slow skeletal troponin I to the cardiac troponin I is about the last thing that I know of that cells that flips during maturation. And so cardiac is the mature one, and you can see at 8 months, the host is much brighter than the graft. The graft has some, but it also has, sorry, here is the immature one in purple. So it's kind of a 50-50 mix. It's on the way, but it's not fully matured. But by 14 months, just a scant few cells express the immature isoform of troponin I. And it's really quite robust. The cardiac troponin I is essentially equivalently intense to that of the host. So it takes a while. I mean, it surprised me how long it takes, but they eventually get there. It seems like there's no intrinsic block. But we really did this to study the immune system. And my clinical work has been as a transplant pathologist, and I work with the heart transplant program and diagnose rejection. And so we looked at these hearts with the eye of what would we do for a transplant patient. So we looked for the infiltration of T cells, B cells, macrophages, and things like that in the graft itself. So again, looking at the graft host interface by hematoxylin and eosin, this would be looking for little blue cells. Blue is bad, is one of the rules of pathology. And if we don't see any badness here, and looking at for T cells and B cells, there's essentially none to be found. You know, just the occasional surveilling cell, but really no accumulation. So this is whistle clean from that standpoint. So that's interesting. How about the other end of the spectrum? What about complete immunological mismatch between graft and host? So we then went on to do that, and this is some work that's in rejection at various journals at the moment. We wanted to know, because I don't think this will scale. I don't think autologous scales, and so we wanted to see if we could find an immunosuppression regimen that would work. There's a sociological question as well, like what are cardiologists willing to do to patients as well? It's kind of a begin with the end in mind thing, and so it turns out if this is ignoring transplant cardiologists and just doing plain old cardiologists, we actually hired a survey firm to do a survey with 100 practicing cardiologists and ask them, would you immunosuppress for this treatment if it would give you a 25-point increase in ejection fraction? And it turns out cardiologists are very chill about arrhythmias. They don't mind those at all, but they have the heebie-jeebies about immunosuppression. And they did not like strong immunosuppression. It just things tipped precipitously. If we have to suppress them, like for heart transplantation, no way. But if it was more like a rheumatoid arthritis patient, okay, we'll give it a shot and see how it goes. So the idea was to find a regimen that spared steroids and cyclosporin, which were probably the two most toxic elements of immunosuppression regimens. And we used our monkey model to do this. And I'll skip through the design. We did the best we could. These are complicated things to do in non-human primates. And so we came up with three different regimens, or four different regimens: tacrolimus only, abatacept, which is a co-stimulatory blockade only, then TAC plus mycophenolate mofetil, which is an anti-proliferative agent, and then TAC plus abatacept as the four groups. And we did this old school. We use histology to grade rejection when we took the hearts out. And the first thing is there's no magical immune privilege, blah, blah, blah. If you take allogeneically mismatched cardiomyocytes, you transplant them in, the immune system finds them and rejects them. So I told you blue is bad, and look at all the blue that's in here. These are little blue cells, T cells, B cells, macrophages crawling through and killing off this graft. And the graft is marked here with this immature troponin stain, but it's just being infested with these cells. And if we left this much longer, the graft would be completely gone. So, not, in a way, not surprising. We'd hope for a break, but we didn't get it. And we found one regimen that three of the regimens failed miserably, but one worked quite well. And that was lucky, I guess. Tacrolimus, where the grafts turn out about as clean as they did in the autologous situation. One had a little bit of rejection out of the four animals. But there's not a lot of little blue cells here by H&E, and a very low burden of T cells and B cells by immunostaining. So what if I told you here? Autologous works pretty well. We didn't see this neoantigen problem. And we've gotten them for 14 months, which is like as long as it's practical to test in animal models, I think. That allogeneic cells, the good news is they're not as immunogenic as a whole heart, but they are immunogenic and the immune system will take them out. We found this immunosuppression regimen that we think will keep them alive long term with the limitation we only could do this study for 4 months. And it avoids side effects and we think it'll be adopted. So I'm just going to wind up telling you where I think we're going to go in the last couple of minutes. We're looking to take a shot on goal in patients. And one of the interesting things about coming down to USC has been taking advantage of the vast population of the basin, that USC is a quaternary referral center for patients with advanced cardiogenic shock, where they come in critically ill and have mechanical support devices put in place. And the scheme goes like this. The most common cause they're admitted is for having a large myocardial infarction. They lose a huge chunk, say, of their anterior wall, and they go into acute shock just due to pump failure. They're brought in, and they are hemodynamically stabilized by putting them on support devices. And so here, one of them is called ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, where blood is taken out of a large vein, say the femoral vein in the groin, and it's first pressurized in this pump, and then it's run through a membrane oxygenator, and it's pumped back into the femoral artery on the contralateral side. That turns out not to be enough. You need a second pump in place, a catheter-based pump that snakes its way up from an arterial access point and is placed in the left ventricle, and this is called an Impella, and it takes blood out of the left ventricular chamber and puts it into the aorta. So this is standard of care for people with these massive myocardial infarctions, and they remain the most critically ill population in cardiovascular medicine, I think. And this is a Kaplan-Meier survival curve from the data at USC, but this is what they look like all over the world. These patients are really sick. The timeline is a little hard to see, but this is just 60 days. So 25% 1 week mortality, 50% 1 month mortality. So, but we've learned our cells work best in the acute situation, not in the chronic situation where it's burned out heart failure. So these are the people we think will be able to help. So we've got a very complicated scheme of, these are complex patients, but we plan to treat them surgically because we can't put another catheter in while all the patients are so heavily instrumented. But it boils down to this, basically. We're going to do our thing. We'll grow our cells in a bioreactor. We'll cryopreserve them until we need them. We'll do what's called a dose preparation and put them into an excipient, a very straightforward saline-based media that will be used to transplant the cells. We will hand them off to a surgeon. She then will deliver them surgically to a patient and will incubate them and let them do their thing and watch and measure a bazillion different things. And we, with the Gantt charts tell us that we can begin this trial in the fourth quarter of 2027. So wish us luck. We've been on this chase for a long time. And the last thing I want to say is more about the culture of science and the way we do things. When I came to, it was really fun to make this change and come down to USC. My predecessor, Andy McMahon, had built this fabulous department, and it was really built on embryology, and the mission was to learn how tissues form in the first instance. And I'm reminded of this quote by Victor Homburger, who's this fantastic developmental biologist from WashU, who's got this quote, that a real teacher has been and still is the embryo, who is incidentally the only teacher who is always right. And I love this quote because it's sort of humble yet snooty, and it sticks with me, and I want to put a yes and to that, and I'm trying to bring in a second pillar of thought and focus to this culture, which is we need another teacher, and here our teacher is going to be the patient, and the patient, by the way, is always right also. Because in the end, we have to let the patients teach us how to do this. The embryo teaches us how to make tissues in the first instance, but the patients in the end will teach us how to regenerate tissues. And so I came up with this term of industrializing regenerative medicine. Part of the trick of making this happen is that we're all doing it in separate laboratories. Each person can only work on a little piece. And industrialization evokes smokestacks and soot and that sort of thing. And so I don't like it for that reason. But what I mean is doing something at scale that has impact. And think of when we went from DNA sequencing to just know ATGC versus to enumerate, and we don't use it to discover sequences much. We mostly use it to count sequences now, and it's made a huge impact with and I think we need to do something in regenerative medicine as well and build an engine for discovery. And it all will start with stem cell engineering, and we'll learn how to make the cells. But then we have to bring in the host. And the thing, there are certain things that are, you know, we started out thinking, let's just regenerate the heart. But really, so much of this is platform technology that's going to be the same for the brain. It's going to be the same for beta islets, for diabetes, and so forth. And so we're all going to struggle with immunology. We're all going to struggle with vascularization. We're all going to struggle with parenchymal-specific things, in my case, mechanical and electrical function. And I want to bring this in a way that we, from every so often, we loop out and test this in patients, take the lessons back in, and use our small-scale systems to make new discoveries. You know, so it's I want to go from a single disease to sort of a platform that we are working in. At USC, we're, you know, doing what we're good at is heart, joints, kidneys, and CNS. But if people want to, you know, if this sounds like your cup of tea, you should maybe come talk to us. And we're very interested in moving this into the clinic. I want to build this team with people who want to do something that doesn't quite exist. I don't want to just publish papers anymore. Papers are the currency of what we do. We can't ignore it. We'll die, but we won't die. But I want to integrate biology, engineering, and medicine. I want to work on problems that are unsolved still, that are high impact, and maybe people who want to see some work touch patients in their professional lifetime. How, you know, that's kind of what we all thought when we got into it. At least that's what I'm speaking for myself. So we have openings, and just saying. And, you know, if this should resonate with anybody in the audience, I'd be happy to chat further. With that, I want to thank everybody who made this possible. This is my crew from when we were in Seattle in 2024. This is our burgeoning group in 2026. We went down to with a big crunch and sprang back. And I have to thank first the taxpayers of the United States who have supported us continuously for 3 decades now. My goodness. So thank you for paying your taxes. And then a whole bunch of funding sources along the way. We were most recently very fortunate to get a large award from the Marcus Foundation that's going to cover the costs of getting us all the way through this clinical trial that I just described. So with that, thanks very much for your attention. If there's any time left, be happy to take a few questions.
Who has the first question out here?
So it's great, Chuck. Really fun to hear. And one comment first, as a hematologist who does transplant and immunosuppression, no problem. Arrhythmias give me the heebie-jeebies.
Exactly,
so it's,
right?
It's, you know, the other way around. How you scale this, so presumably you can't cryopreserve these cells, and you have this.
Did you say can or cannot?
Cannot.
You can.
Can you?
We are able to, yes.
Okay, so in because you have this bioreactor, do you have to, can you just thaw and infuse, or do you have to sort of recover?
We have to, at the moment, we have to wash and concentrate. Yeah, sorry, go ahead, please.
But that's pretty straightforward because, so you don't need to have a continual supply. You can just ship
them,
wash them.
So we've uncoupled manufacturing from delivery.
Okay, yeah, no, so that's obviously going to be important to scale and everything else. The other option is then like hypoimmune cells, if you're looking at those. I don't know what Sana is doing with this, but you know, you got Sonia Schrepfer in town there now. And have you tried with that? And is that another option?
So part of what Marcus is funding us to do is to work on hypoimmune. And just like I wasn't an electrophysiologist, I'm not an immunologist. And so we're looking for good collaborators to help find the right way to edit and screen cells and so forth. And so transplanters are particularly helpful, Dan, just saying.
Yeah, well, I can give some advice, but... yeah, but, you know, I assume you know Sonia Schrepfer.
I do. Yeah,
stuff,
Sonia and I worked together for 3 years at Sana.
Yeah, that, yeah. I mean, would seem to be promising, but looks great.
Thank you.
Hi. Fantastic talk. I learned a lot. Sorry, right here.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. I was really struck by your slide that showed kind of like the calcium time course of what the cells looked like before engraftment, a week after, and then 4 weeks. I'm wondering, at the 1 week time point, if you guys have looked into where rear to the proteins localized, like the different pools, and even T-tubule formation, because it's my understanding that when we make stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes, the T-tubules are pretty immature, and I wonder if maybe in that 1 week to 4 week period, there's some type of like maturation that's happening that has to do with the calcium sparks.
So we've done, to the first part about protein localization, these cells are starting to get some architectural specialization in vitro, and then when we enzymatically disperse them, that all the cytoskeleton collapses into a tangled ball of filaments adjacent to the nucleus, and all of the membranes associated with it just come in, are dragged along with it, and so that whole process has to be rebuilt in vivo after transplantation. That may be part of the iatrogenic stress of the transplant process. Probably happens every time we freeze and thaw and replate our cells and that sort of thing. We just don't think about it. And so there is just, it's a total hot mess. And then, the second part again, please.
I think I forgot the second part. I was asking about T-tubules.
Oh, T-tubules, yeah. Sorry. So they by 1 month, they have respectable T-tubules, but not before. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
This questioner mentions that certain newborns who have congenital heart disease, for example, anomalous left coronary from the pulmonary artery, will have large infarcts but seem to regenerate. Adult heart transplant recipients seem to have at least a little host engraftment into the transplant. So do you really believe the heart has no regenerative capacity, or is it just enough, it just not enough in adults?
So we're all born with the ability to regenerate our hearts. I believe that. And surgeons have always told me, pediatric surgeons always told me that the kiddos are different. And I think that that's true. I think we've seen that now in multiple species, and we believe that to be true. But it gets pretty tightly locked out. We've looked hard in transplanted hearts with sex mismatches, and we've traced extra cardiac progenitors and found that you can repopulate the coronary microcirculation with endothelium quite robustly. Maybe 20% or so of the coronary endothelium is host-derived. But it's about 1 in 10 to the minus 4 for cardiomyocyte, you know, Y positive nuclei in a female heart. So the extra cardiac, there doesn't seem to be much. And then endogenous, there I don't dispute there's a little. I think the heart can probably slowly replace a few through mitosis of pre-existing cardiomyocytes, but it's just not up to the job for a sudden loss like in an infarct.
Cool.
That was a good question, by the way. Yeah.
Great talk, Chuck. It was great to see the update. I look forward to end of next year, seeing it going to patients. I was curious if you can talk a little bit more about the rationale for the trial design, since I think not a lot of people have looked at that patient population. Is it really just because if you do get arrhythmias, they're on a support device, just wondering if you can talk about kind of why you chose that patient population. What would be a phase two then still? Yeah.
So I agree with everything you said except for the word just. Is it just because it's all about risk benefit, right? So these pumps are great risk mitigators. If they should have an engraftment arrhythmia that was not well controlled pharmacologically, they have pumps that can maintain cardiac output in the setting of ventricular tachycardia, and that assuages a lot of my concerns personally about that. So it is a safety thing, but part of it is the biology of the cells, that we know that the potency is much greater if we come in the acute setting than if we come in the chronic setting. It's hard to see efficacy in a small animal when we come in. The cells will engraft, but they don't improve function much in rodent and guinea pig models. And so it's a combination. I think the risk and the benefit tip favorably by going to this population of cells. And I just have little enthusiasm to start my clinical work in an area where we don't expect much efficacy.
So the same questioner who challenged you before about not having any do you really believe in no regeneration, also then followed up with, great story, well told, and now is asking, where would you actually put the cells when you do a transplant? Would you put it into the dead zone, border zone, vascular territory?
That's a really interesting question also. What we have done so far is try to remuscularize the central ischemic region because that's where the greatest deficit is. But I think we also have to pay attention to the border zone because part of the progression seems to be creep of this lateral border zone. There's all this stress, biomechanical stress that's there, but there's inflammatory stress and fibrotic stress and all that kind of stuff as well. So we at the moment are hitting both the border zone and the central ischemic region. We haven't systematically addressed that as well as I would like. And so we know that it works pretty well doing it that way. But we haven't tried just one or the other.
Cool.
I have a very basic question about the fibrosis. So every time you injure, the heart will produce fibrosis, right? So when you introduce these drafts, you also are doing like a sort of injury, and you have like, do you have formation of fibrosis along with your stem cells regenerating, and what's the ratio between fibrosis and the new cells that you are generating?
I think that's a super important question. I'll tell you what we know and then where we're going with this, but we think the cells, if we measure fibrosis using, say, late gadolinium enhancement by magnetic resonance imaging, we see that the infarct, that the cells induce about a 20% shrinkage of the infarct. So a little bit, you know, so the scar tissue seems to shrink a little bit through longitudinal imaging studies. Mostly we displace the scar. We don't replace the scar by putting this graft in. So we don't think this is perfect. I had for a while a program in fibrosis in the lab, and then it just gets to be doing too many things all at once and not making enough progress on any one thing. And my wife tells me I've got to focus and regenerate the damn heart if we're going to move down to Los Angeles and do all this upheaval that we've done to our life. So I'm trying to focus right now. But it's super, I think it's extremely important. And so I consider that like a 2.0. We've also found if we put stromal cells in, like epicardial cells that give rise to fibroblasts in the heart, that actually markedly enhances engraftment. It enhances remuscularization and improves function. It does. It could have caused more fibrosis, but it doesn't. So the cells are smart in some way. So we'd like to do that also, but right from a regulatory standpoint, exponentially more complicated than just a single cell. So we're starting with one because it seems to be enough to make things better.
All right, we'll take one last question from Zoom. This one isn't, I think is intended to be provocative.
Excellent.
So it's a good one to end with. If AI could solve one major bottleneck or make something better in heart regeneration, what would you want it to tackle first?
The immune system. That's the thing I wake up thinking about all the time. Before it was the arrhythmia problem, I would have loved AI to solve that so that we didn't have to spend 5 years. But AI wasn't there and we weren't there, et cetera. So I would put AI on the immune system. I'm not sure I even know how to put AI onto it. You have to learn how to use these tools also. And I'm still on the ascending limb of that curve as well. But I think it's a super complex system. And so that's where I could use the help the most.
Okay. Well, this has really been a great provocative talk. Let's give Chuck a hand and thank him.